We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Want to put your baseball skills to the test? Then get ready to show your stuff with MLB Pitch, Hit, and Run. The official youth skills competition of Major League Baseball. Sign up for free for a chance to play your way to the Pitch, Hit, and Run finals at the 2024 World Series. Visit pitchhitrun.com today.
Good morning, everybody. Sunday morning in the Delaware Valley, along with my pal Ray Dinger. I'm Glenn Macnow here on this overcast day, and much to talk about. Ray Dinger, how are you? Everything good by you?
Everything's just fine, Glenn.
Actually, as we start, I know you had a little announcement to make, a little disappointing change in schedule for today.
Yesterday we were talking about a book signing that was supposed to take place this afternoon, signing my new book, Finished Business, at the Barnes & Noble in Broomall in the Lawrence Park Shopping Center. That has been postponed. It won't be 2 o'clock today because they don't have any books at the moment. So they've been.
Ray, you're a victim of your own success.
Either that or a faulty delivery options. I don't really know which, but they are promised that the shipment of books that they ordered will arrive tomorrow. So we are rescheduling the signing that was supposed to be today at 2 o'clock. We're going to do it Thursday from 5 o'clock to 7 at the Barnes & Noble in Broomall in the Lawrence Park Shopping Center right there off Sproul Road. So if you're planning on coming out there today at 2 o'clock, don't do it. Save yourself a trip. We will be there Thursday night from 5 to 7.
All right, very good. By the way, one other thing before we get to today. I got so much positive feedback, and I share the opinion of those who reached out to me about yesterday's Tell Us Your Story with Troy Vincent. Ray, it was a terrific interview. It really was. Great questions from you and just compelling answers from him. I think I said yesterday we've now done 77 of these Tell Us Your Stories. This has to be one of the top five. It was riveting stuff. And boy, what a he was a great player, and I admire him even more for what he has done off the field and how and the life he's lived.
Yeah, when you and I talked about doing Troy as a Tell Us Your Story, we both agreed that he would be a really good subject because he was such a good player. Because we had both dealt with him, we knew that he was a bright guy. Who definitely had a well-defined life off the field as well as on. So we knew it'd be good. But man, he was great. I mean, he actually shared some things in the interview that were surprising to me. I mean, him talking so openly about his mother being a victim of domestic violence and growing up as a little boy, cowering in the closet with his little brother, listening to his mother be beaten by her boyfriend at that time. He had offered that testimony before the U.S. Senate a couple of years ago, so I knew he had talked about it. But I don't know that he had ever talked about it on our air before, but he did. And also talking about his when it came time to leave the Eagles, that it was really his decision and not Jeff Lurie's, not Joe Banner's, not
Andy Reid's. They offered him a matching contract.
Yeah, they offered they matched the offer of the Buffalo Bills, and he just said, you know what? No, it's time for Big Brother to go. It's time for Brian Dawkins to take over as the leader here. It's time for Lito Shepard and Sheldon Brown to play. It's best. It's my time to move on. And he made that decision. I had never heard him say that before.
No, was unaware of that.
Yeah. So I mean, it was a great interview, and he's a terrific fellow. And I got a lot of reaction too on my end. People saying, "Wow, I always really liked Troy Vincent before, but I like him even more after hearing that." So that was great.
Mm-hmm. By the way, Brian Propp next Saturday on Tell Us Your Story will be a good one. All right, I want to start the show today with something we used to do all the time, don't do it as often, five questions for Ray. And there's a theme today, Mr. Dinger, which is, have you changed your mind? Let's admit it, Ray, you're not a mercurial sort. You're not often fooled by the moment. You tend to form an opinion based on data and facts, and you stick with it, correct?
Try to. I follow the science. Who else said that? Wait a minute. I'm trying to think. Anyway, I try to as much as possible.
Well, here you go. This is sports race. So sometimes things change. All right? Mm-hmm. All right. Question number one. The last three games, the Phillies have won on their final at-bat. Walk-off. I mean, even if you blow a five-run lead and need to do it in extra innings with a zombie runner, which, by the way, is a great name for that, putting the man on second.
Yeah, I actually kind of like that.
Yesterday, in a typical four-hour game in front of the first packed house of the season, the Yankees were here. They sold tickets. The Phillies score four in the first to shut up those Yankee fans. They blow up in a 7-2 lead, and then they fritter it away. Top of the ninth, Hector Neris walks two. Up comes DJ LeMahieu, and then this.
As LeMahieu trying to keep the line moving for New York. One out, top of the ninth, and the 2-2 pitch swung on, hit well to left. Cutchin going back, he looks up, and it's gone. This game is tied.
You got to be kidding me.
A rocket off the bat of DJ LeMahieu. It's his fourth home run of the season. And we start over here in the ninth inning. It is 7-7.
All right. First of all, Ray, it's time for your daily review of Larry Anderson's brilliance.
Just, he is the best.
He's a minimalist.
he really is. I mean, he says so much in so few words.
Five words.
That's just absolute brilliance.
Okay. But wait, Ray, we go to the 10th. All mm-hmm. right. And here comes the zombie runner, as we say, Ronald Torres at second base. Joe Girardi has a sacrifice bunt, National League move. Travis Jankowski lays it down, actually beats it out. So Torres at third, Jankowski at first. Two batters later, Gene Segura hits this sharp grounder to third base. Gio Urshela, the Yankees' third baseman, can't quite get it.
Makes a very nice stop.
Yeah, well, actually, let's play the moment.
And the pitch. Swung on, ground ball, diving stop for Shella. He's got it. Torres coming home. The throw gets away. Segura does it again. Ronnie Torres, after stepping on the plate, he's going to be the first man to get to Segura and start the dog pile again. What a week for the Phillies. Their third straight walk-off victory. 8-7, the final over the Yankees.
All right, Ray. So here comes the question. We have been disappointed this season for a multitude of reasons, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we know that magic can occur in sports. A team gets hot. A team believes in itself. A team gains momentum. Something happens. You remember, I know you remember because you've told the story, the 61-yard field goal against the Giants in 2017. Your pal Seth Joyner, early in the season, third game, said, you know, magic.
That's exactly right. Seth was the first one to say it.
Okay.
And of course I said, Seth, you're crazy. Not in exactly those words. You never speak to Seth quite that way. I just said, I don't know if I'm ready to go
Seth,
there.
I may disagree with you respectfully.
Right.
Okay. Well, Ray, you get the chance to change your thought process on this because third straight walk-off win. First time this franchise has done that since 2013. First time in the majors since the Dodgers did it, I think, 4 years ago. So, Ray, is there magic in the air?
No.
It's not even, what are you, Larry Anderson?
That's what I was trying to do. We started off by saying how great, you know, talking about the minimalist. You can't be any more minimalist than N.O.
All right. It wasn't just even the tone. It was the words. No, that's it. Dismissed. Three straight dog pile. You heard dog pile.
Mm-hmm.
Gatorade bath.
Yeah, I know.
Momentum. Something in the air.
Well, I said at the start of the year I thought that they were a slightly better than 500 team, and I think that's what they are. You know, I just don't think that this is the start of a great sprint to glory here.
Yeah. You
know, I think that they. I mean, I think haven't we seen enough to this point to know how really desperately flawed this team is?
Yes,
in so many ways. Yeah. I mean, there are a couple things that I think. I think that they kind of are what I thought they were. I said coming in I thought they'd be about a 500 team, and right now they're back to 500. It took them three straight walk-offs to get back to 500, but they're back to 500. Yeah. And I think that's kind of what they are. I will tell you this. I've sort of given up on the Atlanta Braves. You know, I kept looking at the Atlanta Braves as kind of the sleeping giant in this division. You know, I kept looking at them and saying that's the one team here that's capable of really getting hot and really putting on a run and just running away with this division. Well, I've seen the Braves enough now that they ain't that. I mean, the Braves kind of this is one of those seasons for them. It just ain't there.
I agree.
So they're not.
All right,
going
one
to
down, three to go.
Yeah.
I don't believe in the Marlins.
No.
I know they made the playoffs last year, but everything last year was weird.
No, and Washington, beyond Scherzer, their pitching staff isn't very much, so Washington isn't going to budge much. To me, it looks like the Mets division to lose. You know, and I think the Phillies are just going to kind of hover around. But the one thing about what's happened here in these last few days is it does keep the season afloat for the Phillies. It does keep people interested. And I think it was really important that it happened now because – when I was on with Joe and John last week, we were talking about the Phillies' schedule immediately after this homestand was going to really get rough. I mean, they go out to the West Coast. They have to play the Dodgers and the Giants, who are both playing really well.
Yeah, then the Phillies-Giants, by the way, is going to be a great storyline with the manager.
But yeah, it's going to be. Yeah. And then after that, I think the schedule gets really hard for them. They come back and they play a couple games against Washington. Okay, that's not so bad. But then they got to go play four up in New York against the Mets, who are playing well. And then right down the line after that, then they have to play the Padres, who are a good team. Then they have to play the Cubs, and you know that stretch of games beginning with Los Angeles, beginning with the Dodgers on tomorrow, and then continuing really past the 4th of July. Is a brutal stretch where they play a lot of teams with winning records, and they play those teams on the road where the Phillies have not been very good. And if they hadn't sort of righted the ship here in these last few days and gotten a little couple wins and gotten back to 500, they could have found themselves buried. Yeah. I mean, really buried by the middle of July. So maybe this little gives them a little energy, a little hope going on this stretch of games. But I think ultimately over time, you know, they're going to kind of find their level, and I think their level is right around 500.
All right, well, so the first question, Ray, have you changed your mind? The answer is a resounding no.
Right.
I can't really argue with it. So here comes question number two. I'm going to stay with the Phillies for one more. Gene Segura, Ray, second straight game, Mr. Clutch. You saw him out there dancing with his teammates, one of the guys, getting a Gatorade bath.
Mm-hmm.
Now hitting .329
right.
In mid-June. Best batting average on the team. 838 OPS. I mean, for a middle infielder, that's pretty excellent. Game-winning RBI yesterday. Tom McCarthy on TV says the right guy in the right spot.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think? Warming up to Segura a little bit?
No. I think he is. No, he is what he is. I mean, this is. We know he's a good offensive player. He's always been a good offensive player. He can. We always knew he could hit, and he's hitting. I mean, that's kind of what he is. But he's not a good defensive player. And we've seen evidence, you know, now multiple times that he doesn't hustle and he's a defensive liability. So it isn't as if we've just seen the epiphany of a new Gene Segura. I mean, we've just kind of seen the old Gene Segura, but doing what he does best, which is swinging the bat. But, you know, as far as is this suddenly going to be a turning of the page moment for Gene Segura? No, he's been in the big leagues long enough, played on enough different teams, that I think we kind of at this point know what he is. He's a guy that can hit. And to Tom McCarthy's point, I kind of get what he's saying, that in this lineup, in that situation, I'll put Segura up at the plate because I know he's going to make contact. He's got a chance to hit the ball hard, which he did. But that's kind of what he does. I mean, the rest of it defensively and in terms of the clubhouse and his relationships with his teammates, I think he's always going to be what he is.
Let the record reflect that I have not disagreed with either of your first two answers. I'm here to aiming to stoke conversation and kind of do a litmus test of you and, of course, of our audience. If you want to reach out to us, 215-592-9494. But I am not strenuously arguing with anything you have said so far, even as you're doing your best Dennis Green, we are what they thought we were.
Yeah. That's kind of – as you started this whole thing by saying that I am always – you know, the pragmatic person. I am always the realist. Which sometimes
you don't get caught up in the emotion of the
moment. I try not to, but I don't want that to be construed as being, you know, Mr. Negative either.
No. I just want honest opinions.
Now, I try to see things through a clear lens as often as possible.
That's why people
doesn't mean you're always right, but I mean it's just kind of the way I view things.
All right, we're gonna go for number three.
Oh, all right.
We'll try one more time. We'll switch. We'll go Sixers, okay?
Okay, good. I think that's good.
Yeah, let's see if you've changed your mind on this. Because a little spoiler alert, I have not. Question number three, the Sixers are ripping through Atlanta on the way to an Eastern Conference final showdown with either the Nets or the Bucks. Either will be a tough series, probably particularly Brooklyn. But Sixers are playing very well, and if they're healthy, they have a real shot to go to the finals, and dare I say, maybe, just maybe, we get the first parade in this town since the Super Bowl parade. Ray, we have a guest at 11. His name is Jake Fisher. He's an author.
Mm-hmm.
Covers basketball for Bleacher Report. Does a nice job. He's written a new book. The book is called Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. You and I have made no secret over the years of despising the Sixers. What was it, decades-long tanking process? How long did that thing go on?
It felt like centuries, but
right,
decades, decades might be closer to the truth.
How old did they say Moses lived in the Bible? Whatever, 900 years? Yeah, I think it felt like that. Anyway, losing on purpose, Ray, really went against everything that you and I believe in as sports fans, okay? But
right.
This guy's going to, he's going to come on, it's Jake Fisher, and he's going to come on and tell us this was a great idea. And that it's a great idea because, let's be honest, it's worked. And the Sixers are a very good team, and I don't know if they would have gotten there had they not tanked. So my question was, you can do as much Larry Anderson as you want on this, Ray, I'm telling you, because you will want to. Is it possible, Ray, that tanking was a good idea?
No. Well, that's three straight no's.
Uh-huh. That's good.
No, I mean, I have this discussion, debate, argument, however you want to frame it, with some friends of mine, people who are believers.
You have friends who are believers in this?
Matt Pfeiffer being one. Who may actually be listening at this very moment.
Yeah, I know.
He is.
I get that. Yeah.
He is a true believer in the process. I mean, he has a picture of Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid hanging in his house. So, I mean, he...
What is he, 12?
He's totally Sixered up. And he's not just jumping on the bandwagon here. I mean, he believed in this back when a lot of people had not. So I give him points for that. But just the principle of tanking, of the losing on purpose. I can never abide that. It just runs counter to everything that I believe that sports should be. And if it works and wins this team a championship, I'll be happy. You know, I'll probably go to the parade. You know, I'll probably, you know, we'll be on the air here celebrating the fact that the Sixers won their first championship since Moses and Doc played together. And, you know, we'll all feel good about it. But the idea that that sort of somehow justifies what went before, I'm not there. I just the whole idea of playing with intent of losing and throwing away not just games but entire seasons is something I never agreed with, and I don't think I ever will.
Ray, I could not agree with you more, and I don't think I could say it better. So I will let that stand. I absolutely. I'm excited about this team. I'm watching all these games, hoping that they go the next. Well, they're going to go the next round, and the round after that, and the round after that, and maybe, just maybe, things are great, and I'll be all excited. But yeah, I never abided by that. I just thought it was unethical. But here we are. Okay, question number four.
Maybe Jake can change our minds.
He's going to try.
He'll try. In 1 hour's time, he'll come on here and try and change our minds.
There you go. Okay. Question number four is not a Ray Dinger, have you changed your mind? But it's an interesting thing that came up that I want to run by you. Chris Sims, who, you know, played 8 years in the NFL, he ruptured the spleen, right? Wasn't that kind of the beginning of the end for him?
That is correct.
Yeah. Yeah.
And played with it.
Yeah. Okay. Never was the quarterback his dad was, but hey, that's not unusual. Currently an analyst for NBC for Pro Football Talk Live. And he's in the middle of a very good, compelling feature, very smart. He is slowly unrolling his top 40 quarterbacks in the NFL. He starts at number 40, and he's going all the way to number one. And I don't know if he does one at a time or a couple a day, but he's gotten up to number 17, Joe Burrow. By the way, Carson Wentz number 18, which probably is about right because the potential is there to go much higher, and last year he was much lower, so that's where he's putting him. This is what he's projecting all of these to be in 2021, okay?
Okay.
So you figure the top 16 will all be those above average to great starters, right? There's 32 teams. He's going to do the top 16. You know who they are.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm looking at his list that he has revealed from number 17 to number 40. And there's Big Ben, and there's Fitzmagic, and Daniel Jones, and you start to get into the 30s. He's got the journeyman, Andy Dalton, Teddy Bridgewater, Tua. Tua's in there. He's got the backups down there, Tyrod Taylor, Case Keenum. He sprinkled a couple of rookies in there, Trevor Lawrence, Trey Lance. I mean, guys who've never played, right, are there right there around number 30.
Mm-hmm.
You know who's not on the list?
Well, the way you're setting this up, I'm guessing that Jalen Hurts is not on the list.
He's not. Unless Jalen Hurts is in the top 16, I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
Jalen Hurts, according to Chris Sims, by the way, I should have prefaced this. Chris Sims, somebody whose opinion you respect?
Yes, very much. I think he's a very good football analyst, and I think he's particularly good breaking down quarterbacks. I think he really does that well.
Well, here we are then, aren't we? The guy who is very good at breaking down quarterbacks and a very good football analyst does not consider Jalen Hurts to be among the 40 best quarterbacks in the NFL. Math tells me there's 32 teams. That means he's not even one of the top backups in the NFL. Ray, he's your starter this year. What do you make of this?
I'm not tremendously surprised. I'm a little bit surprised, but I'm not tremendously surprised. Because I think what Chris, it's maybe a little unfair of me. I'm sounding like I'm trying to read his mind. But I don't think he's being as critical of Jalen Hurts as much as he's just saying, I'm reserving judgment until I see more, which is actually kind of where I am. You know, now would I put him ahead of Trey Lance? Yeah, I probably would.
Tua? Because
Trey Lance hasn't played. Trey Lance hasn't played a snap in the NFL.
Right, Tua. Tyrod Taylor.
Well, yeah, you gotta remember. I mean, Jalen Hurts has played four games. In effect, he's played four games.
Okay.
You know, and Tua has played more than that.
Yeah.
And he's been up and down. He's had some very good moments. He's been a lot like Hurts, to be honest. There are times he's looked really good, and there are times when he's looked overmatched, which is kind of what we've seen with Hurts. Except in Tua's case, it's a larger sample. I kind of view Tua and Hurts as almost the same guy. Really, it's just we've seen a little bit more of Tua than we've seen of Hurts. But I think what Chris is kind of saying is I need to see more. And I kind of agree with that. I kind of need to see more, too.
I would buy that if Justin Fields wasn't on the list.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
The fact that you have, and especially, you know, guys like Lance, who I think is very much an unknown. I mean, he's hardly played college football,
right.
Much less NFL football.
Yeah.
So, I mean, but I guess what he's saying here is that he deems their skill set, their physical equipment, their size, their arms, to be superior to what Hurts has right now. And that's the only thing I can base it on. But listen, you know, it doesn't really matter.
We'll see,
Jalen Hurts can rewrite all of this. He can rewrite all of this in one season, and put himself somewhere in the teens. I doubt that he's going to jump top 10 the first season. But, I mean, he can put himself up in the discussion for the 12, 13, 14, 15 guys with one good season. But it's up to him to do that.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. It is one guy's analysis before anything happens, and preseason predictions, it's particularly in the NFL, often strike me as the most worthless things in the world. But I got to say, an Eagles guy, a little bit insulted on that, a little bit.
Well, you know, if you're Jalen Hurts, this is just a little bit more fuel to the fire, you know? I mean, this is just him. I don't expect, he's going to get asked about it. I'm sure he's going to get asked about it at training camp. You know, the list that came out and Chris Sims, blah, blah, blah. I don't think he'll take the bait. You know, I think he'll probably say, well, that's one guy's opinion, which is what I would say. I mean, just play it smart. Don't make it a big deal. You know, don't start talking about chip on your shoulder in a public kind of way. But I'm sure he hears it, and I'm sure it's driving him a little bit. There's a part of every one of these athletes, especially guys that rise to the level of NFL quarterbacks, that they are uber competitive guys. And everything that they – look, Tom Brady, my God, has won 7 Super Bowls, and he's still mad that he was a 6th-round draft choice.
Oh, if Tom Brady's not number one on this, he'll take note.
Oh, for sure. I mean, yeah. And trust me, he'll talk about it.
Yeah.
Hurts won't, but he knows what's being said, and he knows what he has to prove. And it's probably driving him to work even harder this offseason, which ultimately, for Eagles fans, that's a good thing.
Yeah. 215-592-9494. I didn't get to something that I really want to kick up when we get back, which is Chris Long, who we love. We love. Chris Long played 2 years here, and I wish it was 10. Anyway, he said something in the last week on a podcast that I want to play for you and take it to the larger picture of who we are as Philadelphia fans. But I'd love to hear from the people. We threw out some Phillies, some Sixers, and some Eagles in the first segment. If you got any thoughts on that, 215-592-9494. Ray Didinger and Glenn Mack now taking you up to Phillies Yankees this afternoon on 94 WIP. Ray Didinger, Glenn Mack now, 94 WIP, Sunday morning. I saw a great tweet that I just want to run by you before I give you my Chris Long thing. There's you're familiar with Barstool Sports.
Yes.
Actually, the guy who we're going to have as a guest at 11, Jake Fisher, does work for Barstool Sports. Anyway, there's a local guy who writes here called Smitty. You know what? I think I got that wrong, didn't I? Did I get that wrong, Moshe?
Jake, I was just saying that Jake Fisher writes for Bleacher Report.
Bleacher Report, excuse me. I'm sorry, my mistake. I felt wrong when I said it. I'm sorry. He writes for Bleacher Report. Anyway, Barstool Sports is a whole other thing. There's a guy locally named Smitty who writes for them who's very funny, and he wrote something yesterday, posted something yesterday I just thought was brilliant, and he posted, "I really feel for those Yankee fans who are forced to watch this underachieving team while LeBron is out of the playoffs. At least Dak is back this year for the Cowboys."
In other words, all the front runners, right?
Yeah, it's the same fans, right?
Yeah.
So somebody actually responded and said, well, at least they get to watch the Coach K farewell tour.
Oh, that's good.
Right.
Yeah, that's a very nice addendum. I like that.
Yeah. Anyway, okay. So we love Chris Long, right?
Mm-hmm. Very much okay. So.
And we have to get him as a guest on Tell Us Your Story. We just have to figure out how to get through to him. And he'll be an all-timer for us if we can get him. But he's got a podcast that he does, and actually, I think this was, he sat down on with a guy named Tom Segura. I don't know if he's related to Gene Segura, and he was on his podcast, which is called Tom Talks, and he was asked the question of kind of late in your career. They went through his career and talked about his years in St. Louis and all of that. Let me preface it by saying this. He said, I would have retired as a Ram, but they moved to L.A. I'm not an L.A. Ram. I'm a St. Louis Ram. And to be honest, the team that I most associate with now, he said, well, Boston, I was there for a year, loved it, but Philadelphia. And I want to play this where he talks about playing late in his career, winning a Super Bowl with the New England Patriots, and then coming here and winning a Super Bowl with the Eagles. This is Chris Long on Tom Segura's Tom Talks podcast.
I end up in New England, and that was a relief, right?
Sure.
Because it validated my career to me. But I also wasn't, like, the biggest part. You know, I played hundreds of snaps, 600-700 snaps. But, like, you know, in Super Bowl, I played 20 plays. I was a role player.
Uh-huh.
And so I wanted to go out and finish my career, like, on a high note and be the player I was earlier. So he took a stab at Philly, who's bottom four in the league, get picked to be, you know, bottom feeders. And I just liked the speed with which their defense played. And to get lucky there again, the one was like you join a machine. You're trying to be a part of, like, you get a stadium seat, right? In Philly, you get a luxury suite. You know, you're a part of history there.
Amazing. Amazing.
And dudes, you know, meeting you and being like, hey, I've been a fan I've waited 60 years for this. And they're crying and they tell me, thank you. I'm like, dude, thank you, bro. Like, you're the reason this is so special. It's not the players. It's the bonding of this city, and everybody has waited for it, and this very special, unique team.
He gets it so much, Ray.
Yeah, in every respect. Yeah,
yeah. This guy was here for 2 years, and I'm going to give you the other thing he said, because he went on and he said, Boston, I was there for a year. I loved a lot about that, but I didn't live in the city. I wasn't a big part of the community there. Fans were supportive, but I didn't get to know them the way I knew them in Philly, and a lot of that was geography. I don't know what that means. I was there for one reason. Oh, Boston. Okay.
Right.
In Philly, it was like the city just got a hold of me. So if I ever do the official retirement something, I'll probably do it as an Eagle. And Ray, my thought is this. I mean, we're not unique as a sports city. My wife is from Boston, and her uncle was a lifelong Red Sox fan, and he was among those who always said, hey, I'll die happy when they win one. And he was joking, except that then they won one in 2004, and he died the next year. So it's like, I honestly believe there was a connection with that guy. And we've heard that. But there's something. And this is what I want to explore a little bit. I'd love to hear from some people on this. Your story with your son at the Super Bowl, after the Super Bowl, celebrating and hugging and kind of the tears that followed and how it related to your dad and your grandfather, that became a viral moment. And I know you've heard from hundreds of people who shared that. So I want to ask you, what is it that Chris Long sees or saw? What is he talking about? What is it that resonates in this town that a guy like Chris Long, who, and I know both of his parents went to Villanova, and so I know there's a little bit of an early history of them in this city, but really, he was a St. Louis Ram and then a Patriot, and then he came here, and it hit, and he talks about the fans. What is it that he sees?
Well, I think what he's really kind of talking about is the difference between what winning means in New England and what winning means in Philadelphia. What the Patriots winning means to Patriot fans vis-a-vis what winning means to Eagles fans. They are two entirely different feelings. They are in two entirely different realities. That's kind of what he's addressing. In New England, In New England, for the longest time, the Patriots were a non-entity. The people in Boston, the quote-unquote Boston sports fans, who I think are really good fans for the most part, they're all about the Red Sox. They're all about the Celtics. They're all about the Bruins. The Patriots were a non-factor.
Yeah, forever.
Up there forever.
So it's hard for people who aren't from there to understand. Boston and Detroit, I think, are the only cities where the football team ranks fourth in not anymore because of everything, but traditionally ranked fourth in popularity among the four franchises. That's just around here. That's unheard of.
Right. And part of it was the geography. I mean, part of it was the fact that the Patriots played in Foxborough, which is not even really close to Boston. And there was no real reason to connect with them. And so the fans didn't until the Patriots got really good. And then the Patriots got really good. They got Belichick. They got Brady. They started winning Super Bowls. And all of a sudden, you had a whole bunch of people that were kind of Johnny-come-lately fans that jumped on the Patriot bandwagon. And, you know, that's okay. I mean, I kind of get that. I mean, but it's an easy thing to do, to get behind a team when it's winning and when it's a dynasty. I mean, if that happens, yeah, and people are going to go to it. But it's a whole different kind of commitment, and it's an entirely different kind of history than what you have here in Philadelphia, where the fans in this city – I mean, literally grew up with the Eagles as part of their family. I mean, it was something that, not just in my family, but I'm sure the people that are listening to us and people at large in this community, Sundays in Philadelphia for years, I mean, going back to the Bednarik and Van Buren days, Sundays were built around the Philadelphia Eagles. And that was true when they were a championship team, and that was true when they were a 2-11-1 team. I mean, it was just, you know, the Sundays were, they could either be joyous or they could be miserable, but they were all revolved around the one team. So when that team goes on the run that they did in 2017, and they go to the Super Bowl, and they finally win a Super Bowl, I mean, that sense of euphoria, that sense of, well, now I can die happy, is a very, very real thing. And it goes across all sorts of generational lines. So I think what Chris Long is saying is, you know, I won two Super Bowls here. I won them just a year apart, and I won them with two, but I won them with two different teams. And it was two different kinds of experiences because people in the Patriots, the people in New England, they're happy when the Patriots win. But it's not like what happened here in Philadelphia. It's not even close. And, you know, so some athletes, that would just kind of be a so what? You know, what does that really mean to me? Okay, the fans are celebrating, they're happy, but what does that mean to me? But Chris Long is a smart enough guy that he appreciates that difference. And that's why when he's talking about Philadelphia has a special place in his heart was because he more than I think most athletes identified with what this meant for the fans. For most athletes, it's just, what does this mean for me?
Well, that was Chris, the other thing, yeah, I was going to ask.
I think Chris Long is one of those rare guys who sees it through the eyes of the fan as well, and that's one of the reasons that, you know, that's one of the reasons I really like him, you really like him, and a lot of people really like him.
Because he's not just there for the players, he's there for the fans, and he understands where the fans are coming from.
Yeah, and you saw that. Even though he was here for 2 years, you saw the way he connected with the fans here. And every time he did an interview and every time you saw him, I mean, what he said, you could tell he genuinely meant that. I mean, he related to the people in the city, and he understood what that win, what that Super Bowl meant to the organization, to the ownership, to his teammates, to the coaches, but what it meant to the region at large. He got that. I mean, he got that, and that's kind of what he's addressing here.
He understood the generational part of it, which is the part that I'm most surprised about, and it's a part that I know because I've lived here for 30 plus years, but something that I think is incredibly important in this city. Maybe it is in other cities. I don't know, but I think that part of the hunger in this town, you know, the Eagles hadn't won since 1960, right? So
right.
People who remember that that last championship before 2017, or they're collecting Social Security, right? So it was I think that what happened in February 2018 was the culmination of whatever age you were. Like, I've never seen this. My dad's never seen this. You know, my grandfather was 10 years old when he saw this. This is not just for me. This is for all the people that came before me. And it's really what you, right? I mean, you talked about seeing the eagle on your garage, or your wife
right.
seeing the eagle on your garage a couple days before, and seeing that
the
as
day
an
before,
omen. And
Saturday,
yeah. And you're not like this, you know, super religious, spiritual guy who sees omens and everything. But
nope.
that really connected with you. And I think that's the part of it that Chris Long sees that to me is the most important part.
Yeah, without a doubt. I mean, everything you said is 100% true. And I've told this story before, but it certainly is in context with what we're talking about now. Was when I arrived at the Art Museum the day of the parade, I was walking to the broadcast position that we had for NBC Sports Philadelphia. And I'm walking along the street, and there were millions of people behind the police barricade. So I'm sort of walking along, and this one guy starts calling my name. And he's waving me over. So I come over to just say hello to him. And the guy says, I have to show you something. And he was wrapped in a blanket, and he said that I had gotten here like 6 o'clock in the morning because I wanted to stake out this position and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And he reaches in his pocket and he pulls out this photograph, and it's a photograph of a little boy and a man. And I can see it's Franklin Field. And he says, this is my father and me. At the 1960 championship game. And when the Eagles won that day, you know, we made a promise that every time the Eagles won a championship, every time the Eagles played for the championship, we would be there to celebrate that moment together. And he said, so they went to New Orleans to see the Eagles play the Raiders in Super Bowl 15, and of course they lost. And they were in Jacksonville to see the Eagles play the Patriots, and they lost. And he said, you know, my father died 2 years ago. And he said, I felt like, he said, when I watched the game on Sunday, he said, I had his picture in my pocket. And he said, when I knew the parade was scheduled today, he said, I felt like I had to be here for him. And he said, I brought this picture with me. And he said, it's, you know, and he's showing it to me. And he says, it's sort of like he's here with me today. And I said, and he said, I guess that sounds silly. And I said, not at all.
No,
I know.
Doesn't sound silly in the slightest.
I know exactly what you're saying, and I'm feeling the same thing. I mean, I'm here today, and I'm enjoying it. But I'm thinking, I wish my father was here. I'm thinking, I wish my grandfather was here. And you know, that's how deep this thing ran. Anybody that just says, "Oh, the Eagles won a football game," you so don't get it. I mean, you have to have lived this thing your whole life to really understand what this meant to those people and what a real, real thing it was. And that's why the moment that I had with David being on television and, as you said, going viral, I mean, we didn't know it at the moment. I mean, it was just a father and son moment. But it spoke to literally millions of people, and to this day I still hear about it. And I don't know, you know, I mean, I don't know that would
you
happen
understand
in
why
every
now,
NFL
right?
city. I don't know if that would happen in every NFL city, but yeah. It certainly happened here.
You understand why now. I think at the time you were surprised by the reaction, and if I know you correctly, you were a little embarrassed at kind of choking up as you did. That's not something you anticipated doing. You didn't see that as professional TV post-game analyst.
That's correct. Yes, that's exactly how I felt. I felt, you know, I had tried very hard to keep my emotions in check and to just be the, you know, be the analyst and to be the X's and O's guy and break down the stats and all that kind of stuff. I mean, like, I was very happy for the city. I was very happy for the fans, all the people I knew. I was very happy knowing what was happening back in Philadelphia, knowing how the celebration was going on. And I felt all of that. And I felt great for all the people, and I was overjoyed. But I felt, you know, look, I'm on camera here. I'm an analyst. I'm supposed to be objective as I can be. And I kind of kept that all reined in until David came, and then we had that moment on camera, and I hugged him. And then I started thinking about my father and my grandfather, and I just became overcome by it. And and so we had that, and when I was a little embarrassed because I knew it was being televised live back to Philadelphia, and I knew the audience was huge, and it was so out of character for me. But as Governor Rendell said when I sat down, he said, don't worry about it. He said, you know, the people in Philadelphia, that moment you had with your son, he said, that's happening all over the city. He said, Everybody understands it. And they did.
And it was great. And it really was, for a lot of people, a very memorable moment of the day. And I think that you doing that on TV, I mean, you just kind of alluded to this. You doing it on TV represented it happening thousands and thousands of times around the Delaware Valley with generations. And Chris Long gets it. And that's kind of what got us into this. So, you know, we open a little conversation about that. We'd love you to check in with your thoughts about that. 215.
For him, that was really beautifully stated by him.
Yeah.
But not a surprise. He's a very unusual guy. I would love to get him as a television
star. I know. We got to strategize that because I don't know how to reach him, but we got to get that going. 215-592-9494 if you've got a story in that regard with Ray Dinger. I'm Glenn Macnow. Ray Dinger, Glenn Macnow, 94 WIP. Coming up at 11, we're going to talk to Jake Fisher. Wrote a book about tanking in the NBA. Ray, I think he thinks it's a great idea. So
he's not alone.
I know he's not. The Sixers' performance now, I'm sure, puts a little wind in the sails. He wrote a book, Paul, Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tank Era Changed the League Forever with Triumph Books. Actually has some great stories in it. I mean, he interviewed more than 300 people for it. And there's some great anecdotes that I want to get to about him. And coming up a little afternoon, our old pal Sweeney Murdy, former news guy for WIP, now the Yankees beat guy for WFAN in New York, is going to join us for pregame. Right now, let's talk to Ed in Palm Bay, Florida. Hello, Ed.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Hi, Ed.
How you guys doing? Ray, I read your papers in the Daily News back in the 60s, early 70s. Been a season ticket holder for the Eagles since 1977.
Okay.
And there's nothing like Eagle enthusiasm. Like, it overshadows every other championship we have won. And I love all the Philadelphia sports teams.
Yeah, but I think the Eagles are special. I agree with you.
They are absolutely special. The game they beat Dallas with Wilbert Montgomery, the first play, ran 81 yards. I was there. Like I said, I was a season ticket holder. And when they won the Super Bowl, I got to tell you this, I threw everybody out of the house. Nobody. I'm watching it by myself. Turn my phone off. I don't want no texts. I don't want any calls. And that was the most exhilarating thing in my life, when the Eagles won the Super Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, yeah.
Well, let me ask you.
You're living in Florida now,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Yes, I am, and I still come up there a couple times a year. I still have season tickets.
Ah, good for you.
So when the Eagles win the Super Bowl, and I guess he runs out of the house because he has nobody to celebrate with, right?
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah?
Yeah, yeah.
Nobody's
out
on the streets honking their horns or anything.
Yeah. Yeah, you run around with pots and pans, you know, around your condo.
Oh, yeah.
You know? Very interesting, Ray. The first three calls we have on this are from Palm Bay, Florida, D.C., and Alabama.
I noticed that.
What is that saying? What do we make of that? I don't know.
It says Eagle Nation spreads far and wide.
Yeah, I guess it does. Carl joins us. He's a good caller. We've talked to him before. Hello, Carl.
Good morning, guys. Absolutely outstanding show. Ray, tell us your story with Troy Vincent was just a home run. Absolutely an incredible yesterday.
Yeah, he was really good. I knew he would be, but he went above and beyond. He was great. I'm glad you enjoyed it, Carl.
He did. A couple of quick Eagles comments. Something Nick Sirianni said earlier this week on the end of the OTA press conference. I've been in education for 20 years. I've worked with wounded soldiers. And the one thing that is evident is everybody learns differently. And the fact that Nick brought that out and mentioned that all players learn differently and at different speeds and in different ways, and that he's trying to find that mix is tells me he's not only invested in the team, but invested in getting the best out of the players. Because you normally don't hear that. You normally don't hear a coach adjusting to the players except trying to get them to learn the plays.
Mm-hmm.
And that just tells me that him and his coaches and the players are all on the same page. And as much as the players are listening to the coaches are going to listen to the players.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I really like that. That's something different, and I think it's going to really benefit us going forward.
Yeah, Glenn and I talked about this a little bit last week when Sirianni, he had just had his final press conference. That's the one you're talking about. And I said to Glenn at the time, there's a lot that this guy has said now, and we haven't seen him coach a game yet, so we don't know exactly how it translates to the field. But there's some things that he said now in his last couple press conferences that I find myself nodding my head and saying, I like this. You know, I think this guy's on the right track. Now, does that necessarily mean he's going to be a great coach? I don't know. But I think that his idea and the theme that he's hammered home from the very beginning about it's competition, 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 that this training camp is going to be all about competition, the guys competing for jobs, and the guys, the player, the guys that are going to perform the best every day in practice, blah, blah, blah. If he really means that, and he's kind of convincing me that he really does mean it, then, you know, I think that's a good thing. I really think that one of the problems that we have, not just in football, but in too many professional sports right now, is too much is handed to players based on contract, based on draft status, based on name, based on whatever kind of politics go on behind the scenes. Sometimes the competition part of it, which to me is the purest part of sports, is forgotten based on salary and other factors. If this guy really means that this is going to be a competitive training camp and the most competitive players and the guys that show the best are the ones that are going to play, then I think it reminds me so much of the way Vermeil rebuilt the Eagles. And I think that even though that was the 70s, I still think that can work today.
He's either going to be, to me, a great success or a flaming failure, but we will find
out.
We'll
see.
Yeah, hey, there's a call I got to get here before the break because we got a call from Hollywood, Ray.
Oh, yeah.
The executive producer of Last Dance, only one of many great critics, Mike Tolan, joins us. Mike, we appreciate you listening at 7:56 in the morning out there.
You know, I have an 8 o'clock Zoom with your friend and mine, Pat Croce, but I figured
love him.
If I might come in a little late, I wake up this morning and you're talking about Super Bowl memories, I had to chime in because it's a 50, almost 60-year saga for me, like almost everybody. But I'm 5 when the Eagles beat the Packers in 60, and we sat in Section ND at Franklin Field, went every damn game, watched all those hard losing years year after year. But in 60, I guess they got 2 Super Bowl tickets, so my dad took my older brother, and he says to me, "Don't worry, honey, you'll go next year." So there we go, through the procession of Jurgensen, Snead, Hill, Kincannon, Gabriel, Jaworski, all the way through. Like Ray, I got myself some nosebleeds and went to New Orleans and went to that Super Bowl fiasco against the Raiders over by halftime, I remember, after Jaworski threw that interception. Years later, I worked on a script about Leonard Toews and did a little 30 for 30 short starring Glenn, your partner, Ray Dittinger.
Remember. It was great.
We went into Steve Sable's old office, and Vermeil, Jaworski, Jimmy Murray, and Ray, and we sat around and we talked about. And as I recall, Ray, Vermeil said, we celebrated too hard after the win over the Cowboys, and we just kind of weren't ready to win another game, right?
Yeah, that was kind of Dick's view of it, and I don't know if it was a celebrated too hard or they just they spent so much of their emotion in beating the Cowboys that it was hard to get that back in just 2 weeks' time. I mean, they weren't the same team when they played the Raiders, and I think they played their Super Bowl against the Cowboys. I really do.
Right. It sort of felt like that for a lot of us, just to beat the Cowboys that way, the Montgomery run. It was just like, how much better can it get, right?
I think so.
Anyway,
that's true.
Fast forward, I get married. I'm moving to L.A. I tell my wife I have one little thing I got to tell her before we do the move. And she goes, she loves to tell the story. It's like, oh, man, I'm going to find about these two kids he fathered living in the Dominican Republic or something. And I said, well, even though we're moving to L.A., we're going to have to raise our kids Philly sports fans. She said, okay, that I can handle. So we have this beautiful girl, Georgia. She fakes it for a while. We adopt a beautiful boy, Lucas. She passes the baton, and I got my guy who's just, like, in all the way, you know. Phillies, Sixers, not so much Flyers, but Eagles. He turns out to be a massive football fan. He gets to Jacksonville, and he was 4.5, and I just didn't feel it. And somehow I completely forgot the history. You know, the whole point of being a parent is to break the cycles of despair or disappointment, and I didn't do it. I went, I had my own disappointment. I'll never forget that walk of shame, walking along the river with Patriot fans yelling and screaming at us. I came home, I said, Lukey, I'm never going to another Super Bowl unless we're in it, and you're going with me. My dad sadly passed away a couple years later, but here we are. It's 2017. He's a senior in high school now. Created a monster. He comes with his Eagle jerseys, and he's got all the stats, and he's more into it than any of us. We go to that incredible game in the Coliseum against the Rams. So Carson tears his ACL, somehow scores a touchdown anyway. We bring in Nicky. He leads us to the game-winning field goal drive. We're walking out of the Coliseum. My savvy sports fan, Eagle fanatic, Lukey, says to me on the way out, Dad, I wish we would have lost the game and not lost Carson. We're dead.
Oh.
And I go, Lukey, remember that 27-2? Remember, there's pixie dust when Nicky walks onto the field. Don't give up. We come back to Philly. We go to that horrific Christmas game where somehow we beat the Raiders without scoring a touchdown. It looks, I mean, as you guys remember, we open as a home dog.
Yeah, first time ever.
Yeah. And Julio somehow doesn't catch that pass, and we win. I got a whole crew of L.A. Philly fanatics eating tasty cakes, cheesesteaks. Here we go. I turn to Luke. That's the pixie dust. That's why Julio didn't catch that ball. So Minnesota happens. I gotta get the tickets because whatever. I've been anointed the ticket guy. We have 18 Eagle fans at a restaurant in Minneapolis the night before, yelling E-A-G-L-E-S, Eagles, in this upscale steakhouse. And my son couldn't go. He came with me, obviously. But before dinner, he says, Dad, I can't go to dinner. Why not, honey? I have a headache. I think I'm too nervous. Oh. Oh, no. All right. You go to sleep. Order a cheeseburger from room service. Rally. We'll be ready for the game. So we are, and we do. And I see Dornbus there, John Dornbus, our favorite. And he's sitting right near us, and he gives Lukey, the biggest hug. And my son is so stoked. And we sat, and we held hands, we hugged, we laughed, we cheered, we bit our fingernails for whatever that was, 4 hours. And when the game ended, we were both in tears. I'm crying for my long gone dad, who never got to see another one. And he's crying because it's the happiest day of his life. He will tell you 3 years later, what was the best day of your life? Oh, no doubt. Me and Dad went to the Super Bowl and Eagles won in Minneapolis. So, you know, we're praying for another one. We're back in every Sunday and, rooting for Sirianni and the new guys. But it has been a journey, and it doesn't get any better, as you guys
Mike,
know.
Mike, that was beautifully told. The kicker to this movie has to be 25 years from now when you're an old man sitting on a chair somewhere, and your son takes his son, or your grandson takes his son, or somebody and says, hey, the Eagles won again, their ninth Super Bowl, and that one's for the old man, Mike.
Ah, I love it, man.
There you go.
Hey, one more thing, guys. I will get you Chris Long. That's no problem.
Gee whiz. Okay.
Give me a minute, and I'll find you.
We're on it. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mike.
There you go. Great call.
There you go.
Have a great one. Well, that worked out well for many reasons.
Yes, it did.
And it was a great story. We're very late for a break. Let's take the break. We'll come back, and we look forward coming back to talk to Jake Fisher.
To his left, triple team fights through it. Oh. What a pass for Simmons and the throwdown. What a play by Embiid as he was falling out of bounds. Everybody. 14-point lead for Philadelphia here in game three with a series tied at one apiece. Game four, Monday night. Embiid from Simmons.
Yeah, that was beautiful. Whoever he is playing, it doesn't make a big difference. He's using his body. Here he is, finding Embiid coming down right from the top of the circle, right down the middle of the floor. Look at that.
There you go. That's a really nice job by our producer, Moshe Kravitz, putting that together, a nice montage of recent Sixers action, which brings us to our guest. Jake Fisher is the author of a book called Born to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever by Triumph Books. It is out now and available everywhere. You can follow him on Twitter, by the way, at Jake L. Fisher. That's with a C in Fisher. Jake, thank you so much for being our guest today. We're looking forward to talking to you.
Yeah, thank you guys for having me. I don't want to be that guy, but I do have to be that guy. The book's called Built to Lose, but again, I appreciate the opportunity, guys. I'm excited to talk about it.
Oh, what did I say?
Yeah, I think you said Born to Lose.
Oh, I'm sorry. Excuse me.
It's okay.
I'm sorry. So, the book focuses on the league, but the franchises it focuses on most, I would say, is currently in the second round, up 2-1 against the Hawks. Before we talk about the book, let's talk a little bit about the Sixers and where they are now. As a guy who covers the league, if Embiid stays healthy, how far do you think they can go? Can the Sixers get past Brooklyn or Milwaukee? And how do you think this shakes out?
Yeah, I mean, I was getting kind of excited listening to that clip that Moshe put together. I mean, hearing Hubie Brown like talking about Embiid like that, he's not wrong. I actually texted a bunch of my friends from the area. I'm not a Sixers fan anymore. I feel like the objectivity just kind of comes with the job, but I'm certainly rooting for the team right now to help book sales. And like, I really think if Embiid is continuing at this level, which, you know, obviously every time he falls down, it's a gasp if that's going to be the last time. But at least for this playoff season, I don't want to get too carried away. But if Shake Milton is contributing off and on, if Furkan Korkmaz is contributing like he has, if they get that bench performing like it is, I know that daunted Doc bench lineup is something that Philly fans have gone back and forth with. But if they can slide Tobias into that group, and if those contributing pieces continue to supplement Joel like that with all that shooting, why not? I think that team really is a shot to win the title.
Yeah, they're very good. When Embiid's playing the way he's playing right now, they really are. And, you know, Glenn and I talked a little about this yesterday, but one of the things that I thought was most impressive about the first game in Atlanta, the last game they played, was Atlanta did a lot of different things defensively. I mean, they tried to do some different things to neutralize Embiid. They doubled him at times. They put three guys on him. They kept changing the defense.
Yep.
They kept running guys at him. And one of the things that the more I watch Embiid, I become impressed with not just what a great physical talent he is, but what a thinking player he is, what a smart player he is. When he, you know, when they get double teamed on him, you never see him get flustered. You never see him turn the ball over. You never see him make a bad decision. When he sees a defense collapse on him, he holds on to it. He looks around. He finds the open man and gives somebody a better shot. He never forces it. You know, he never tries to drive into trouble and turns the ball over. He always turns that around. When if he can't make the play, he'll find somebody else who will. I think sometimes his basketball IQ is maybe the thing that we appreciate the least about him, but probably we shouldn't.
I agree. He's an actual basketball savant. And obviously him and Trae Young both get a lot of attention for their foul hunting. The difference is that Trae Young does positioning, gimmicky type stuff. I'll come out and say that. I don't care. It's the truth. What Joel Embiid does is he knows how to hunt for contact and to exploit that contact in natural scoring moves. I have this great detail in the book where, you know, obviously he sat out his first 2 years due to that broken foot injury. And it ultimately forced – I played a big role in the Sixers taking Joel Okafor. Honestly, they were concerned he might not ever play. But the one beauty of that time off and kind of the double red shirt that Embiid had was he got to really study the game up close and personal for 2 whole years. It basically took a grad school class for, you know, a lot of guys, or all rookies just drop right in and they have to adjust right on the fly. He had all this time to learn it and assess it. And Chris Babcock, the Sixers assistant coach, told me at one point they were watching film trying to teach him skills and moves and whatever. And Joel started to point out naturally, well, what if I rip through to the left like James Harden does in the perimeter but on the block? Won't I get that foul call too? And he started thinking ways that were more advanced than any rookie they ever had.
Jake Fisher is our guest. You can read him on Bleacher Report. You can get his new book, Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. And in the book, I am looking forward to reading the book. I know you just sent me a copy, but I listened to a few podcasts that you did. And one of the things the book talks about is how lucky the Sixers were to get Embiid. The Cavs had the first pick in 2014. Talk about the tryout he had there.
Yes, he was by all accounts going to be the number one pick. I mean, dating to that January, he had this game at Iowa State where Embiid just—it looked like one of the greatest college game performances ever. Like no hyperbole at all. And the Cavs saw that guy in their facility. They had the number one pick, obviously. But they ultimately chose Andrew Wiggins, and they picked Wiggins because people say—I mean, Cavs officials to this day maintain that and Joel broke his foot during his Cavs workout, the one where they're standing there thinking this is the guy that could potentially pair with LeBron and lead us to a title. They're like crushed, but with the pressure of LeBron potentially signing in free agency, they could not take a player who was going to sit out the whole year. When you get LeBron, the title window is on immediately, just like we're seeing in LA right now. So the Cavs had to take Andrew Wiggins, who was also the prospect that David Griffin, the Cavs GM at the time, knew that Flip Saunders, the Timberwolves GM at the time, wanted the most for Kevin Love in return. So that brings Milwaukee on the clock at number two. And the Bucks, I have Mark Lazary, the Bucks owner, on the record in the book saying that they, too, couldn't take an injured player because they wanted to get back to the postseason. So that brings the Sixers up at number three. And the Sixers even considered potentially drafting Dante Exum there. Hey. Remember, he was the Australian. You need me to go?
Yeah, yeah. Oh.
So he was this Australian prospect of mystery. He had this connection with his father, Cecil Brown, who Brett Brown had coached over there. There was a lot of pressure to take that guy, seeing that he could have been a hybrid piece that paired with Michael Carter-Williams, and they brought him in for a one-on-one workout, virtually unheard of for top prospects. Usually, these guys go one-on-zero and battle against the chair, but they handed Rob Pelinka, his agent at the time, obviously now the Lakers president, a list of guys to go one-on-one with, and they picked Tim Frazier. And unfortunately for Dante, the great news for Sixers fans, Tim Frazier destroyed Dante Exum one-on-one. This undrafted point guard beat up on the top 5 picks. And that cemented the Sixers' idea that when Embiid was going to be available at 3, he was going to be their guy.
Hmm. Wow. Well, you know, the one negative, I guess, that comes out of the game the other night in Atlanta, it was an impressive performance, a little bit of a shaky start. But once they got it going, especially early in the third quarter, they were in full command. But they lose Danny Green. And now comes out that he's going to be gone for a couple of weeks. How do you think that impacts the rotation? How do you think Doc Rivers goes about making up for the loss of a guy who's been pretty valuable to them?
He's been very valuable. Obviously, he got kind of put on notice in game one with Trae Young defensively, but he's been a real key to that number one defense all year long, and the shooting obviously has been tremendous. His pull-up threes in transition can be kind of a kiss of death, or they can be something that sends that home crowd into a frenzy, right? So he's going to be a big piece, and he's obviously won the last two championships. But I think this moment, I could be wrong, but I think it's going to come down. They're going to try a lot of Matisse Thybulle, I think. I think that closing lineup that we saw them use with Thybulle in place, I think his defense. Like, that guy is a breathtaking defender. He honestly, again, I know we've towed the line of hyperbole a few times here, but he might be one of the best perimeter defenders I've ever seen. I mean, he just makes plays that are that take your breath away, and that's the kind of player that can really be a swing piece for an entire game's outcome in the fourth quarter, especially when he's a perimeter specialist on the other team, has obviously a really, pesky point guard in Trae Young.
Jake Fisher's our guest, author of Built to Lose, How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. So, you're talking to two guys, two old heads who completely didn't abide by the tanking, right? Just thought it's an unethical thing to do. In your book, you interview, by the way, more than 300 people in the book, players, owners, coaches, execs. You're the authority now. So let us start with this.
Yes, sir.
There really are no other pro sports leagues that I know of where tanking, multi-season, long-term tanking is a prevalent strategy. In the NBA, it is. It has been an accepted way of life. How does the league, because you talk to people at the top levels, how does the top level of the league view this?
Well, tanking is alive and well even to this day. I went to Sam Presti's virtual end-of-year press conference a couple weeks ago, and the Thunder obviously they're in the middle of a tanking job that's far more brazen than anything Sam Hinkie ever did, sending Al Horford home for half the year and then 17 first-round picks over the next 3 years. And he went out and laid out this entire soliloquy, this opening monologue about how this is what teams like theirs, teams like the small markets, that the only way to compete for a title in this league, as we've seen throughout its history, dating back to the 50s and through the 80s and through the Jordan's Bulls and the era we're living in right now, you need multiple superstars to contend for a title. And the only way to get them, if you're a small market team, truly, is to draft them where they're most available typically is in the top five. So that's he spoke openly about the strategy, and even though it comes with a lot of unforeseen variables and variables that you do see, like luck and ping pong balls bouncing a certain direction or not, it's still the most direct path for a franchise to get those guys. And then hopefully you draft them and they'll be able to attract another one.
Can I make a quick argument to this?
Here's
my quick argument. Last I checked, the team with the best record in the league this year was Salt Lake City, or Utah. Utah, right? Who has had five losing seasons.
Though.
Pardon me?
They did tank, though. That 2014 draft, Dante Exum went to Utah at number five. They were tanking for that year.
Okay, so let us say they were tanking for 1 year, all right? I won't even argue that with you. They were tanking for 1 year, the team, and I think they still won 30-something games or something and got the fifth pick. Okay. It wasn't a six-year prolonged, we're going to try to lose forever. They've had five losing seasons in the last 40, right?
Yeah.
This is not a franchise that has historically tanked. If 1 year, and I appreciate it, it's like 1 year, it's not going to work, we're going to shut it down, okay. I don't think they went into the year with the idea of it, but that does happen. But I don't think that's a franchise that you can say got the best record in the NBA by tanking for year after year. Anyway, my question is, if you're Adam Silver, and I don't know if you spoke to Adam Silver or the people around him, is this a good look for a pro league?
You're right. It's a conundrum the league has to face. And, to your last point, I will say, like, if you look at those successful situations, teams that didn't tank, like, the Jazz are really, really good, partially because Rudy Gobert, 27, worked out, and they had the wherewithal to take him there.
Right.
Kudos to the Jazz.
Right, the Bucks got Giannis at 13, 14, something like
at 15. Yeah, 15, and there's a great detail in my book. The Hawks were doing everything they could to trade up for Giannis at number 13 with Dallas. The Mavericks just did a different trade instead. So the Bucks even kind of got lucky there that the Hawks weren't able to sweep them out from under them. So there's definitely strokes of fate that happened, and I think playing the lottery, while there is luck involved there too, I think the odds are more heavily in your favor, if you will. And if you are an analytics-minded executive like Sam Hinkie or Sam Presti or the other guys in the book, Ryan McDonough in Phoenix, Rob Hennigan in Orlando, David Griffin up in Cleveland, who's now up in New Orleans, like, sometimes you want to take that chance. So, but to your other thought, I think also a big side effect of all those analytical-minded executives coming to power is now we're talking about team-building strategies, and casual fans at the bar are talking about 2023 first-round pick protections now. And while it's great and exciting that transactions allow fans to Photoshop Damian Lillard into their team's jersey every day and hypotheticals on what's going to happen this offseason, like, it's the value of the regular season, and you've got teams like Al Horford or the Thunder benching Al Horford and other players with load management and all that type of stuff. It is a conundrum that the league's got to have to deal with. I think that's why they're considering midseason tournament type stuff after the success of the play-in tournament. I know they are considering a midseason tournament, and I think I reported on Bleacher Report, the G League's going to do a start-of-season type thing next year, and they're fiddling around with ideas that they could implement within the next 2-3 seasons at the NBA level. So I think it's really going to be reckoning, you know, with the actual league business model overall.
Yeah, I guess what I would this sort of brings me to the point that I was going to kind of get around to, Jake, is just the overall state of the I don't like to use the word product, but I'll use it in this context of the NBA of the regular season product of the NBA today. I don't think it's a healthy one. I really don't. I mean, you look at the regular season games. You know, you get into the postseason and you see really good basketball, but the regular season to me seems more meaningless than it's ever been. I mean, you had, for example, there was that one game that everybody's kind of looking forward to it. It was a Sixers-Nets game, sort of late in the season, where you're thinking about this could be a game that's going to decide home court in the playoffs, and the Nets don't play any of their big guys. I mean, they come in and they just kind of walk through it, and the Sixers win big, and it's, you know, there's almost nothing to look forward to in the regular season, and I just don't know that that's a good thing for, if an NBA, if a professional franchise or professional league has a regular season that is perceived as and played as meaningless a fashion as the NBA is right now, I think it's got to be a concern to Adam Silver and the people in his office. If it's not, it should be.
It definitely is. I mean, the proof's in the pudding. The ratings are down. That's such a cliche and a trope to say, but it's true. And I think there's a lot of factors behind it and a lot of things they can do to change it. I mean, smart people than myself are going to have to give the most definitive answer, but it's definitely being discussed. And I think the fact that, I mean, the league needs to be at its healthiest. It needs to be in a situation where any team's fan base can show up to the arena that night and expect that their team can take home a victory. That's just what I remember of my childhood, because I grew up watching those pretty mediocre Sixers teams for, you know, a decade after they made the finals in 2001. But at a certain point also, there's a limit to that too. And that's why, you know, tanking ultimately comes into play, because a lot of teams have realized also that being in that middle ground, it prevents you from being in a situation where you can't really compete for the title, but also can't recruit your roster with, you know, the top of the top young players. But see, it's a vicious cycle, right? It's a chicken and egg type theory that the league's going to have to figure out something.
They are going to have to figure out something. Jake Fisher, it's been great talking to you. His book is Built to Lose: How the NBA's Tanking Era Changed the League Forever. There's fascinating stories in there, I know, about Thaddeus Young and about Evan Turner trying to get away from the Sixers and Sam Hinkie. And I know you look at the league, but you really do. There's clearly the Sixers are a huge topic of this. You can follow Jake on Twitter at Jake L. Fisher, F-I-S-C-H-E-R. Hey, thanks for being our guest today. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, guys. I appreciate the time as well.
All right, Jake. We'll talk to you soon. Yeah, I mean, it's nothing's going to change. The people who are good with it are going to say, hey, the proof's in the pudding. It's worked. Look at how good the Sixers are. And old heads like you and I are going to say, hey, we love the Sixers. We're glad they're going well. But I still feel a little dirty about it. And I always will.
Yeah, me too. And we've said it many, many times, but it's true. But we've said it many times because it's true. It is a very generational thing.
You know, absolutely.
You know, guys of our age, you know, the old heads, we don't abide by the idea of tanking and deliberately losing. It just runs against everything we've been taught that sports is supposed to be about. The younger generation, or the people that are more analytics driven, say no. You know, the worst thing to be is a team that's mediocre, that's in the middle. You have to, if you can't drive to the top, then you got to drive to the bottom. And the only way to do that is to throw away seasons. I just, I just can't do it. I just can't. I mean, I understand. I mean, I've had it explained to me a million times.
Yeah, you get the law. And listen, it, you know, they drafted Embiid because they were willing to lose, and it paid off. The teams ahead of them that didn't draft Embiid regret it.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, and I still don't think I'll ever be on board with it. I just don't.
That's okay, Ray. You can call me anytime you start to have doubts.
Okay, I'll do that.
All right. 215-592-9494. Take some calls. Coming up, Ray Dinger, Glenn Macnow on 94 WIP. Along with Ray Dinger, I'm Glenn Macnow, 94 WIP. Phillies Yankees coming up today, 105 start or thereabouts. We have the pregame starting at noon. Ray, they filled the stadium yesterday for the first time, and by estimates, 30% of the people were Yankee fans.
Yeah, my son, who's a cameraman down there.
Yeah, that's right. What's he got?
He said it was. He thought it was actually a little higher than that. He said it was closer to 40% Yankee fans. But it's just, hey, listen, it's just nice to see the ballpark full again. I mean, 38,000 people. It's been a long time since you had that many folks in the house. So
that's great.
And they'll probably have the same kind of crowd today because the Yankees don't come in that often. And, okay, a lot of folks want to come down from New York. But it's just, you know, it was a little depressing in that last little Phillies homestand there. Not only were they throwing some games away, but to see, you know, 12,000, 13,000 people in the ballpark, it was worrisome. It was worrisome.
Well, I think they do have a long-term problem with the sport and here with the Phillies, but that's a conversation for another time. I think those low attendance numbers mean something, not just, you know, kind of coming out of the pandemic, which could be a little bit of a factor. I think the sport's got big concerns, but that's for another week. Let's get to Tom in Alabama. Man, you're patient, Tom, and we appreciate that.
Thank you for taking the call, gentlemen. It's a big-time honor to be on the line with both of you, especially you, Mr. Didinger. I hold you in the highest regard, sir.
Thank you, Tom. Appreciate that.
I want to try to spit this out. I know you got other callers, but I've said it so many times. I've been here for 45 years, since I was 9 years old. And the biggest misconception, I guess you would say the word, that I've had with the people here is the closest major city to here is Atlanta. It's 200 miles north-northeast. And a lot of them are Atlanta fans. And guys would say to me, I play softball, co-workers. I would always say, where are you from? Yeah, I'm from South Philadelphia. And they would always say, Tom, you've been here for 30 years. You're from here. Don't say that again. I said, you don't like when I say that. I said, well, guess what? That's just too damn bad, sweetie. Because not only am I from South Philadelphia, I'm from the corner of 10th and Snyder Avenue.
There you go.
And it culminates to when we played them in the Falcons in 05 for the championship to go play the Patriots.
Right.
I went to this big party, and I knew I was going to be the only Eagles fan there. There was like 30 people there, and all Falcons fans, good friends today, who have had season tickets since the Falcons started. Well, they got this big spread, and you name it, the steak, lobster, and I'm the only one not eating, and I like to eat. And one of the guys comes up to me and says, Tom, what's the matter? You know, what's wrong? Sick or something? I said, how could you eat at a time like this? I am so nervous, I can't even talk. And, of course, you know, that's the difference. I mean, and I was built into it. And I also went to another party when they played the Patriots, and it was 28-3 at the 5:25 third quarter. And they're saying to me, hey, Tom, you're going to get yours one day. But I'm getting mine today. And I said, well, not just yet. Tom Brady's on the field. Don't be a sore loser, Tom. Well, when overtime hit, I left because I knew what was going to happen. And I've seen it myself. But I am telling you that as a Philadelphian, and I will go to the day I die, there are nothing like the Philadelphia fans. And when I won the Super Bowl, you know, I watched it by myself. And unfortunately, I could not be there because of some issues going on here.
Yeah.
But, I would have just loved to have been there to watch it with my cousin in Somerville, New Jersey, and, you know, take the chance if they win, if not, you know.
I hear you, and you really, and thanks, Tom, and thanks for hanging in. You explained it really well. It is different. By the way, a little bit of breaking news here: Danny Green out 2 to 3 weeks with the calf strain, according to Shams Charania of the Athletic. So that takes him out, obviously, of this series and the next, and maybe back for the finals?
Yeah, that would be probably best case scenario. You get past Atlanta, you get past the next series, and he's available to you in the championship round, but probably not before that.
Yeah, it's a big blow. It's not good. I mean, not surprising, I suppose, but that's not what you wanted to hear.
No. When you saw him in the boot the other night, that was definitely not a good sign.
Right. Carl in Lambertville is with us. Hello, Carl.
Hey, guys. How you doing? First of all, Ray, I just read your book. And it's a great read. It's a readable book. And the stories, the insights, it was so enjoyable. Anybody that's got a Philly sports fan in the family's got to pick it up and read it. Well, absolutely sensational. Really enjoyed the hell out of it.
Thank you, Carl. I really appreciate that. I really, really do. Thank you.
And I have to ask you a silly question about the book. There's a picture of you there with Chuck Bednarik in training camp as a kid.
Yes.
Now, you and I are very contemporaneous. We've done a lot of the same things. We're within a year or two of each other. I used to go there. I swear to God, that's me behind Chuck Bednarik. And if you have the actual photograph, I'd appreciate the chance to see it someday.
Oh, okay.
All of that aside, my son and I had 76ers tickets recently, season tickets. I'll tell you something. It's not to brag. They were half court. They were dead center, 22 rows back, $175 a ticket. And that's regular season, $20 to park your car. Now, I ask you, if you spend that much to see a game, and you, me, Glenn, and two of our friends are the starting lineup, are you getting your money's worth? And they do nothing about scaling those tickets. Yeah. You don't know until you get there who's going to be playing the game. And I don't care how much your kid loves basketball. If you're going to a Sixers game, you're not going to see Ben. You're going to see the big man. And if he ain't playing, you shouldn't be paying. And that's my stand on it. I think it is absolutely awful and almost bordering on criminal because they're fostering a product that they're not delivering.
Well, it's an interesting
lawsuit there.
Yeah, well, there may be. I mean, it is not unreasonable that somebody will say, I spent all of this money and these guys were not injured. They just didn't play. And I deserve to not pay that money for that.
No, I think that's fair.
You can make a case.
I mean, that's fair. I mean, that's, if you go to a Broadway play and the lead actor or the lead actress is not performing, their stand-in, their understudy is performing, they announce it before the curtain, and if you want to go to the box office and get your refund, you can. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's standard practice in Broadway. They have to announce before if there's going to be a change in the leads, and if you want a ticket refund, you can get it. I'm not so sure that in the era of load management in the NBA that you're not owed the same thing.
I think you would be. All right, real quick, let's get Tom in North Carolina. Tom, we got about a minute here. Make your best point.
Yeah. Hey, quick question. Why isn't the Sixers tanking? I'm a casual basketball fan. Why is that not the Black Sox scandal of the NBA? I've lost interest in the Sixers.
I hear you, but it's not illegal.
Well, I mean, if to Mr. Fisher's point about a conundrum, it's more than a conundrum. It's a cancer because I can't follow pro basketball anymore. Like you guys said, they walk through games in November and December and January. And I'm just perplexed. Is it true? I'm away from Philly now, that the NBA had to step in at some point and make them hire a certain GM or some.
They basically pushed out Hinkie and brought in, what the hell's his name?
Colangelo.
Right? Jerry Colangelo or his son. It was a disaster.
I'm having a hard time, like you guys, why anyone thinks that's acceptable.
Listen, we have to run. We got to hit a break, and I'm sorry to cut you off, but I mean, his point is it's illegal for players to throw games, as in the Black Sox scandal, but it's not illegal for management to throw games.
Right.
And it's a great point. We're going to take a break because coming up, we got our pal, Big Daddy Graham, with his list of the week next. Always look forward to that. Ray Dinger and Glenn Macnow on 94 WIP. Always a fun part of the weekend when we get to check in with our pal, Big Daddy. By the way, have you announced the number one album of all time?
Coming this week.
Coming this week.
I'm very excited about that.
Yeah, I am as well. I will tell you there's a Who album in there, a Led Zeppelin record in there, and a Beatles record in there. I will tell you. I'm not
I
sure.
I got no argument with any of those.
Well, you could be. No Beatles you want to argue with. Led Zeppelin's last couple. You know, hey, I love this commercial you got for Boston Lager. Now, first of all, it's a fine lager. Second of all, I'm so happy they're advertising at our fine station. So let me get that kid, that guy, when he talked for one moment in Boston Lager beer, makes me want to punch him through the radio. I hate the Boston Celtics that much.
Yeah. He's every Boston fan you never liked.
Never have. Hey, this was a hard list. Not 1, 2, 3 wasn't hard. But 4 and 5 got hard. First of all, I had to make a decision if I was going to have fun with this or not. For example, a lot of people gave me the Civic Center.
By the way, you haven't announced what the list is. What is the list?
Oh, top 5 centers in Philadelphia history.
Top 5 centers in Philadelphia history. Okay, cool.
And a lot of people had fun with it, like Mike Howard and John Pannone, who were great small centers for the Hawks and Nova. And Chuck Bednarik, great center, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bobby Clark, great center. So there were more centers than I thought would be, but I kept it to basketball. So having said that, coming in at 5, his stats are way better than people remember. And that's Darryl Dawkins. For about 6 years, averaged 15 points a game and 9 rebounds. That's nothing to shake your hat at there. Those are pretty good numbers.
Mm-hmm.
I got him coming in at 5. Dikembe Mutombo comes in at 4. If he never played, I'd put him on his list just so I could go, Dikembe Mutombo. Which all salute to Joe Conklin, who does way better than I do, but he is fun to do. And he was a solid player who treated every defensive possession like you were not going to score. I mean, that was the attitude he played with.
Yeah.
And it was a great attitude. It was a great, I don't think I'm making this up, one of the great defensive players of all time.
Oh, yeah.
No, I think that's fair. Absolutely. I don't think anybody would challenge that.
Yeah, well, now I expect the people to challenge me, but look up his Sixer stats. Darryl's Sixer stats. The problem with Darryl was everybody wanted him to do that every night.
Right.
And he just didn't have him in him to do it every night. Coming in at 3, here we go. He's going to stay at 3. Until he wins a championship, or at least go to a final. And that's Joel Embiid, who, right, is the reason we're doing this list. I mean, he's just, every week he's getting better.
Yeah.
You know, averaging 40 points a game and defensive presence. And, man, we are so blessed to have that guy play in our city and to get to see him play night after night. And that's the key right there, right? Night at the night.
Yeah.
That's not what you got from him. But you are getting that from him this year, right?
Without a doubt.
Moses comes in at 2. He didn't have a long tenure here, but it was long enough for 4-5-4. And to bring a generation of attitude to the next big man that came along, and that is to never give up on an offensive rebound. Even when it was you missing it.
That was his best ones. He would take 6 shots, rebound all of them, the last one would go in.
There you have it. You know, and here's the weird thing and sad thing about Moses Malone. When I was doing research for this list, you know,
people just totally forgot he died.
Yeah, I know.
It's the weirdest thing.
I know. People always tell me we should get him on Tell Us Your Story, which even when it was live would have been a challenge. But anyway, we got about a minute. Number one is no surprise, so lay it out.
Well, it's Will Chamberlain. I mean, granted, he did some of that playing with the Warriors, Livingston, Philly, and did quite a few games in Philly as well. He still sets the standard. It's insane. It really is. You know, for a second there, we thought maybe Kobe is just going to go nuts some year and average like 70. And even that would have never worked. Because, you know, Wilt averaged 52 points a game for one season. 52. Now, I know times are different back then and all that, but I'm sorry. 52 is 52, and I think you got to throw in 27 rebounds with that.
Yeah.
Yep.
Amazing. I mean, just numbers that'll never be approached, no matter what era you put them in.
Like the numbers that you and Ray put up every week in radio excellency.
Well, there's no question about that, and that's certainly reflected in the rankings. By the way, I just have one thing to add to anything you said, which is Joe Conklin doesn't just do a better Dikembe Mutombo. He does a better Big Daddy Graham.
You're going to play him?
No, I'm just telling you. No, I don't have a cut, but he does.
Not only does it do a better me, anybody else who does me does Joe Conklin doing me.
Yes, including Ray, who does it really, really well, but usually not when I ask him. Big, we got to run. You know, we love you, and I look forward to listening to it. Go to BigDaddyGraham.com to listen to the top 100 albums of all time. It's been great.
Later.
All right, buddy, be good.
Big Daddy.
Ray, we have to get out of here because we have a pregame show coming up, Phillies against the Yankees. But before we do, you should tell people one more time about something that isn't happening today but will happen later in the week.
Yes, very quickly. I know that it was originally announced that I was going to be doing a book signing with my new book, Finished Business, today at the Barnes & Noble in Broomall. That is not happening. The shipment of books did not arrive, unfortunately, but we're promised it's going to be there tomorrow. So the signing of today has now been postponed, and it will take place. I am promised that it will take place on Thursday from 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock, the Barnes & Noble in Broomall at the Lawrence Park Shopping Center. I will be there signing books. So if you're looking to go out and get that Father's Day gift, you can still do it on Thursday and have it in time for Dad on Sunday. So Thursday, 5 to 7, Barnes & Noble in Broomall. I will see you then.
All right, tell you what, if you reach out to me with the details during the week, I'll put it on social media. People will see, so we'll get that word out.
Thank you very much.
Ray, it's been a pleasure. Moshe Kravitz produced today. Stay. We got Leading Off coming up next right here on 94 WIP.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.